Good morning. First case of the morning will be United States v. Virgil Carroll. Mr. Habermill?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Alan Habermill. I'm the attorney for Virgil Carroll, the appellant. We're here today because Virgil Carroll wants a trial, not a new trial or a better trial, but just a trial. As I laid out the facts in the brief, Virgil Carroll has a defense to these charges. It's a defense that makes sense. It's consistent with his lack of any criminal record, of any suggestion that he ever even used drugs, much less dealt them. These charges are extremely anomalous. You see a man who's a family man, got a career both in the military and in his personal life working, and yet here he is accused of being some kind of methamphetamine dealer and distributor up in Wisconsin.
But Mr. Habermill, the evidence you emphasize in your brief deals with charges to which he did not plead guilty.
That is correct. The point of that wasn't to demonstrate that he was or wasn't guilty on those particular charges.
Let's suppose he wasn't. Let's suppose he had a perfect alibi to that. He stood up in court and admitted that he had committed the charges in counts 4 and 5.
That is correct. The point of putting in the evidence about his not being guilty on counts 1 and 2 is that these aren't isolated. They can't be looked at in separation. There's an overlap of witnesses, particularly Shawley, but there's also this continuing course of conduct. Also, as you'll recall, count 5 is possession of a firearm in connection with drug dealing activities, and count 5 specifically referenced those activities as being both counts 2 and 4. So even though he didn't plead guilty to count 2, it's included in the charge in count 5. And as part of the basis, it wasn't otherwise illegal for him to have the gun. He had to be possessing it in connection with drug dealing. So the charges are interrelated. And I think if you have to envision what this case would have looked like if it had gone to trial on all of the counts, is what was going
to
happen.
Actually, I think what we have to envision is whether the district court was abusing its discretion and refusing at the stage this came up to allow the withdrawal of the guilty plea. And another thing that struck me from your brief is that it's obvious, you know, that I'll just say there comes a time when Mr. Carroll is in Wisconsin because he has this training at Fort McCoy, right?
Correct.
So he has some Wisconsin link, and he apparently knows these people. There are references to that. I just am not sure, given the solemnity with which we're supposed to take the Rule 11 process and the fact that these concrete pieces of evidence don't actually undermine 4 and 5, the receipt for purchasing the car and the family Christmas celebration and so forth, why we should say that the district court judge has abused his discretion when Mr. Carroll stands up and says nothing I said the first time around is true.
Right. I understand the court's reluctance to do that. I've read the cases. I know the court doesn't like the idea of the defendant getting up and then saying, well, back there, I lied to you, and this time I'm telling the truth. But the fact is that does happen. I think in the last few years we've seen a number of instances of people who, in fact, have been convicted and later proved to be innocent, where the advantage of, for instance, a DNA evidence to back them up, where they, in fact, confessed, pled guilty, and got convicted. People do falsely confess. They do it out of fear. None of us in this courtroom has ever been in that situation of having to look at your wife and your 3 kids and make up your mind what you're going to do. And when you're faced with the situation that Virgil Carroll was faced with, an attorney who 12 days before trial has done nothing, and literally nothing whatsoever to prepare for that trial, he is suddenly presented, and by the way, he had been consistently rejecting plea agreements right up to that day. It's worth remembering that he explicitly rejected an earlier agreement. All of his contacts with his attorney were based on the assumption the case was going to trial. And suddenly, 12 days before trial, what happened is his attorney abandoned him. He bailed on him.
I would have 2 thoughts about that. One of them is that direct appeals like this are not the right time to worry about ineffective assistance of counsel. I'm sure you've seen that mantra from our court. So maybe the attorney wasn't representing him properly. But the other thing I would say is that to portray Mr. Carroll as someone who was completely apart from the world of methamphetamine isn't quite right, in that even the count 4 conviction. They found various things in his room at Fort McCoy. He had a story about it, but it's not like it was completely apart.
What they found in his room was 2/3 of a gram of methamphetamine that he says he had found abandoned in the car after the two girls had left it there. Whether you believe the story isn't my main point here. The question is whether he has a decent defense and should have been allowed to present it. I'm not asking you to acquit him. We weren't trying to do a trial. We just want him to have a chance to give it to the jury. Again, he's faced with a situation where he has to decide, does he want to go to prison for a long time or does he want to go to prison for a real long time? He didn't have any functional third choice. And he got up and he lied to the judge. There's no denying it. We can't be here today saying withdraw the plea after the judge said, did you do it? And he said he did without admitting that. I understand that. But it does happen. People do find themselves in that situation where the pressure of those two choices leads them to go into court and to lie. It's known to happen. It's a proven fact. And I think with someone like Virgil Carroll, who's never been in criminal trouble in his life, the whole process is not only somewhat inscrutable to him. He's got no legal training. He's got a modest education, but also incredibly frightening. And again, that's what I was starting to say. It's very difficult for us to put ourselves in a position of a person like that. But the fact is, he's looking at his wife and his three kids and trying to decide how long he wants to live without him being around. And he took what appeared to be the lesser of two evils. And again, I do think it matters that the government's case is, in my opinion, and with what I was able to do with just the few weeks I had to work on it, demonstrably false with regard to the first two counts. And again, I do think it's important to think about what that trial would look like. If you've got the government with four counts of drug dealing and the gun, and you can prove two of them are false, that's a different kind of trial than if you're just going to trial on counts 3 and 4.
Well, that's certainly true. I'm not sure the government would go quite as far as you just went about the first two counts, because I recall that there's some evidence that indicates he was in Wisconsin for 36 hours or something like that for a brief period of time in December. Maybe not on those days, maybe not in that way.
I'm sorry, but the only evidence of that, as reflected in the record, is the prior attorney's statement that Mr. Carroll had said that to the prior attorney. There's no external evidence of that whatsoever. Mr. Carroll denies saying that, and I went to some pains to try and show why he wouldn't have said that, because it is clearly not true. Again, I think you've got is enough question about his factual innocence. And again, bearing in mind that Mr. Carroll raised this motion before sentencing, not after. This isn't a question of sour grapes. He didn't like the sentence he got from the judge. He thinks he'll try again and see if he can do better. He filed the motion to withdraw his plea long before he actually got sentenced. And I think that's an indication that he was sincere in what he was doing, that it isn't just because he received a sentence that was harsher than he anticipated. In fact, according to the judge, in rejecting our argument that Carroll had been misadvised about the sentencing, the judge said that his prior attorney had accurately informed him as to the kind of guideline sentence he could expect to receive. So merely seeing that repeated in the pre-sentence would presumably then not have come as a shock at all. That's presumably what he would have been expecting all along. So I think the fact that we have been able to establish that he has a credible defense to the charge, bearing in mind also his own character and lack of criminal background, as opposed to the character of the witnesses against him, is enough to demonstrate that he had a case. And while ineffective assistance of counsel is generally a question for habeas, but in this particular case, the particular ineffectiveness we're talking about is that which specifically led to him pleading. And it's therefore part of the grounds for his request to withdraw his plea. Okay, it's not like we're coming again after trial and saying the lawyer didn't prepare or something. It's actually specifically related to the entry of the plea. It's the very failure of his attorney to adequately investigate the case and then present him with the plea agreement at the 11th hour in a situation where there are no practical choices that we are saying is what induced Mr. Carroll to enter the plea and admit to something he didn't do out of fear of the consequences that were going to arise if he didn't do that. I see my lights on. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Connell?
Good morning. My name is Paul Connell. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Western District of Wisconsin, and I was responsible for the prosecution of Mr. Carroll below. This appeal raises three pretty simple issues: whether the district court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Carroll's motion to withdraw his plea. Secondly, whether the district court failed to make adequate findings with regard to an obstruction enhancement that was given at sentencing. And then thirdly, the effect of Booker on the defendant's sentence. And unless there are preliminary questions, let me turn to the withdrawal of the plea issue. This court reviews the denial of a motion to withdraw a plea for abuse of discretion and reviews the district court's factual findings for clear error. In this case, the district court did not abuse its discretion for five pretty straightforward reasons. First, the district court made a simple credibility determination, chose to credit the defendant's sworn statements from his guilty plea, in part because it found that he had perjured himself at his withdrawal. At the hearing to withdraw his guilty plea, and in part because the district court found his plea testimony more truthful, sincere, and non-equivocating, and under Stewart and a litany of cases from this circuit.
Mr. Connell, yes. Mr. Carroll, as I recall, filed this motion. Actually, this is really a question. Did he file this motion after he'd seen the preliminary PSR?
That's right, and that was one of the things I was going to address. One of the things the district court noted was what you have here is the defendant pleading guilty and not a peep out of him for 35 days. His PSR comes out, he gets it, not a peep out of him for 8 more days. And then I think on December 23rd, he sent a letter to Judge Shabazz claiming, you know, I'm innocent, I was railroaded, I was strong-armed into pleading guilty, and so forth and so on. So you had 43 days where there was no issue with regard to his attorney's performance, that he was innocent and so forth, and you had 8 days after the PSR came out. And in fact, Your Honor, the district court specifically noted in the at sentencing and at the hearing to withdraw his guilty plea, page 170 to 71, the district court noted that that was one of the reasons that it didn't find him credible and didn't think he had presented a fair and just reason.
Now, is there any reason to think, the PSR recommends range of 46 to 57 months initially, actually winds up getting adjusted, as I recall. But
he actually ended up with less than that.
Right. Is there any reason to think that that was a shocking level based on, say, anything that happened in the plea colloquy or elsewhere?
I think in this case a little bit, because Mr. Carroll was arrested, a complaint was filed, he was, you know, let out on conditions, we indicted him, then we had a superseding indictment. But he was in Missouri the whole time, and I think this whole Wisconsin thing was sort of out of sight, out of mind. You know, he's having regular phone contact with Mr. Brown and so forth, but he doesn't have to think about it. He's going to work every day, he's around his family, his kids, his father, things that are very important to him. And until you actually get that document that says, here's what you're looking at with regard to count 4 and count 5, by statute, a 60-month consecutive sentence, I think it was a shock. But it still took him 8 more days to concoct a story as to why he wants to go back in time. So let me continue on then.
But the government obviously must have, I mean, there was some shift from a plea that was going to be counts 1 and 5 to counts 4 and 5. The government must have thought that the count 1 evidence was shakier.
Not at all. I think this is pretty clear in the withdrawal of the plea hearing transcript. After that first plea agreement went to Mr. Brown and then was faxed down to Mr. Carroll, I had a conversation with Mr. Brown, and I just said, hey, if he is interested in not having to get up in front of a U.S. district judge and admit to distributing methamphetamine to a minor, he completed the counts 4 and 5 if you'd like. I'm going to fax you over a factual basis for counts 4 and 5. Review it with him before the plea, and, you know, I'll bring another plea agreement to court. And that's what Mr. Carroll elected to do. And just so you're aware, Your Honor, his father, his son, and I think another family member was in court with him, and it probably did make it easier for him to not have to stand up and admit to distributing methamphetamine to a minor girl. Mm-hmm. So going forward, the district court also did not abuse its discretion because the defendant really presented no evidence at the hearing to withdraw his plea with regards to count 4 and 5 other than I'm innocent. And that's the old believe me now, don't believe what I said at my guilty plea. The district judge was well within his right to disregard that. But I think most significantly, the defendant did not address before the district judge at the hearing to withdraw his plea, did not address in any of his briefs filed in this case, and has not addressed it today, the compelling and overwhelming evidence of his guilt. All the evidence found in his room, in addition to the methamphetamine and the firearm that were found on the night of the search. Specifically, there was a jar with liquid methamphetamine in it. There's only two inferences for that. Either it was about to be turned into methamphetamine that can be smoked, or it was wastewater product. But either way, it's in his room. The defendant never addresses the scale found in his room with methamphetamine residue on it, indicating that he had been, in fact, engaged in some form of distributing methamphetamine.
Now, does the record show that mere users, as it were, of methamphetamine don't have scales or liquid
There's nothing in the, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record at all about whether Mr. Carroll was a user. But, you know, he pled guilty to possessing methamphetamine with intent to distribute it. All the witnesses in the PSR, the three young ladies, a woman who's in her 20s, and at least one young man all talked about receiving methamphetamine from this man. The defendant doesn't address the towels with methamphetamine residue, the pipe with methamphetamine residue, and significantly he misses out on and doesn't have an explanation for the cutting agent found in his room, that is a chemical cutting agent that adds weight and bulk to methamphetamine. And also, he didn't deny at any point, as you pointed out, Judge Wood, knowing any of these people. I mean, it was clear. He admitted at his withdrawal plea hearing that the girls had been in his car with him and whatnot, and that's what relates to count three of the indictment. Mm-hmm. The last thing I guess I'll come to with regard to the withdrawal of the plea is the district court found that Brown rendered effective assistance of counsel. Mr. Brown reasonably investigated the facts. Although Mr. Habermill claims that Mr. Carroll was abandoned at the last minute, Judge Shabazz said, well, he was preparing for trial. He had subpoenas ready to go. It's 12 days before trial. Subpoenas regularly go out late like that. Furthermore, Mr. Carroll asked Mr. Brown to explore pleas with a plea agreement several times, and it wasn't just at the 11th hour. It was several times during the case that the defendant, through Mr. Brown, engaged in plea negotiations. Judge Shabazz found that, in fact, Mr. Brown went beyond the call of duty. He traveled to Missouri to meet with his clients instead of having his client come up to Wisconsin. At that meeting in Missouri, Mr. Brown explained in details the guidelines and how they operate. Judge Shabazz also noted that he had reviewed Mr. Brown's CJA timesheets and saw the amount of time that he put in and was very impressed with that. It's also uncontested that at his guilty plea, the defendant admitted he was fully satisfied with the advice, counsel, and representation of Mr. Brown. He signed the plea agreement knowingly and voluntarily. No one forced him to plead guilty. No promises were made to get him to plead guilty. And he agreed with all the facts that I proffered, facts that were provided to him ahead of time and reviewed with Mr. Brown.
Right. Could I just, sure, because time is running out, just confirm that the government agrees that under the circumstances of this case, on your third issue, that the limited kind of Palladino remand is appropriate?
Actually, in this case, Your Honor, I don't think we need to do it. I don't think there's the fog here where there's any question what Judge Shabazz would do. Under Lee and under Cunningham decided yesterday, Judge Shabazz gave him 51 months out of 41 to 51-month guideline range.
But Cunningham does not hold that if you're at the top of the range, though.
No, Your Honor, but I mean, I think it speaks to this. There was an upward departure available, and I don't have Judge Shabazz's exact quote up here, but he said something to the effect of, you distributed methamphetamine to minors, that's a point.
Right.
I should upwardly depart. However, the top is sufficient. It's hard to believe that if you sent it back on a limited remand or on a full remand or on a limited remand, that Judge Shabazz would be at all interested in resentencing this particular defendant.
Well, in which case he'll say, I'm not going to.
That's true, Your Honor, but I guess for judicial economy, I don't think you have the kind of what would Judge Shabazz do if we sent this back in this case. Let me touch briefly, since I see I'm not quite out of time, with regard to the two-point enhancement for obstruction of justice. As I explained in my brief, the judge identified four statements made by the defendant claiming that he was forced to plead guilty. Judge Shabazz said the court has determined that to be false. The defendant's claim that Attorney Brown said to him you'd get 85 years if you went to trial and lost. Judge Shabazz characterized that as totally incredible and intentional lying and deceit under oath.
You know, that struck me as very weird because, in fact, if you imagined consecutive sentences on all of the things charged in this particular indictment, it would be 85 years. It doesn't seem to be utterly, off the charts to say that.
Yeah, for someone who's not a lawyer, but there's no way Mark Brown, and this is what the court found, there's no way any lawyer, any competent lawyer, would say that to his client, and that's what the judge found in this case, and Brown denied saying it. I mean, I appreciate a defendant.
Well, I'm just saying it's not so preposterous, given that that's the precise statutory maximum that you would get.
Fair enough, Your Honor, but either way, the judge found that he perjured himself, and there were a couple other statements that he said, you indeed creative, but false, and offered to avoid sentencing. So I think the judge did what he needed here to merit the two-point bump, and unless there are further questions, I would just ask you to affirm the denial of the motion to withdraw the plea and affirm the conviction, sentence, in all other respects. Thank you.
Hey, thanks. Mr. Harrell, you have what?
45 seconds.
About a minute. So
yes, I'll be
finish it up.
Mr. Carroll was originally charged with manufacturing methamphetamine in the original indictment. The government The government superseded and dropped that charge. All of this stuff about his supposed manufacturing is essentially a red herring. He isn't charged with that. There was no direct proof of it. They searched his room. They came to the conclusion that there was no lab being done there. The claims have variously been out in the woods at Fort McCoy, in his room at Fort McCoy, at someone's house in La Crosse, his many meth labs supposedly in Kansas, and in Missouri. He's supposed to have been doing it in five different places, and yet there's no direct evidence of any of it. All of this, again, does tie together when they make those kinds of claims. And to call Mr. Carroll's story concocted is really overly harsh. His wife came in. His father, who's a correctional officer, came in. We could prove through both unimpeachable testimony and documentary evidence he wasn't in Wisconsin on the dates that he was claimed to be there doing these drug dealing activities in December. And that, I think, throws a lot of doubt on their claims he was doing it in June. And he does go up there every summer. It's the summer, not quite camp, but it's their summer thing that they do at the reserves. And he does meet people. But the mere fact that he knows them doesn't mean he's selling drugs to them. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. The case will be taken under advisement. Move to